Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. It's been a little while. We did all the selected, or the, I call them selected shorts, but
The shorts.
Those went well and gave us a big, nice buffer to take a break from recording a little bit, but I missed it. So I'm glad you reached out the other day and said, hey, let's get some recording done. And it was very, very timely. I got a question, I think from one of our listeners, but it could have been just somebody from Ascendo, said, what is the boiling it down? It was, what do I do if I only get three samples? You know, well, you know, ask for more.
Yes.
This was my first response, but, and I didn't get a good sense of, you know, was it a consumer product or a commercial product or a medical device or is this or that the other thing, but it almost doesn't matter because with your experience and mine, I think we've seen it dozens of times in all kinds of industries. Well, three samples is enough. You know, that's all you get, or that's all the budget is, or whatever.
Isn't it funny how and this may not have occurred with this person who asked the question, but it sometimes occurs where people ask about sample size before they talk about the objectives for the testing. And it seems like in reverse. In other words, where you want to start with, what are your test objectives? Where are you heading? Are you at the system level, subsystem, component? And really talk about what you know, what you don't know, what you need to know. Mm-hmm. And then we can talk about test criteria and sample sizes, things like that. But it's out of sequence to start with the sample size.
Well, you've been there where the program manager says, all right, reliability guy, you get three samples, period. Go write a plan, you know? Or you do due diligence, you work with the team, you got a good understanding of, you know, where the risks are, where the unknowns are, and you go, well, we need to do an accelerated life test, we need to do this, we need to do that. I need 628 samples. And they go, no, you get three. Mm-hmm.
It happens year by year. Let me go back to the 1980s, where this is before I became a reliability manager. I was a test manager. And door testing for Fisher Body, part of GM. And literally, you were given three doors. Mm-hmm. That was it, year after year. I mean, from going back as far as you could see, the plan was three doors. And so I had to work backwards from that to say, what can you learn with three doors? And in fact, when you mentioned this possibility, I pulled out my Lipson book that I've had forever, and it still opens to the same page, page 178, relationship between sample size, testing time, confidence, and reliability. And so that takes me back to around 1983 or 1984.
Oh, wow.
And we were just learning about Weibel. I was. We had brought Dorian Shannon in. In the 1980s to teach early on, and he always taught six samples to get a proper Weibel plot, but we had to figure out what to do with three samples. And so according to Lipson, if you could assume what the Weibel slope is and characteristic life, and then you'd have to decide between reliability, confidence level, you know, what you were going for, and then test time. And those were the variables. Mm-hmm. And then you could solve for any one of those depending on what your assumptions were going in. So I remember early on doing a spreadsheet of reliability, confidence level, sample size, which was three, Weibel slope, characteristic life, and just calculating reliability. You know, what you'd have to do, and actually calculating test time. So we would test to a bogey, going past the useful life or whatever the design life was. How far would you have to go beyond that with a sample size of three So yeah, the history goes back a long ways on this one.
Oh wow. I shudder to think how long off. I get nervous when you go more than say 4 or 5 lifetimes.
Oh my gosh, yes.
You know, because your test becomes pretty bad or invalid when you get some failure mechanism. You get a failure. Now you're like, now I don't have the bogey test anymore, right? Mm. And it could be a failure. And once we do failure analysis, we figure out, oh, well, this failure is a natural wear out mechanism that we have 3 lifetimes of margin on it. So we're not going to fix that, you know, but it masks the ability to test the normal processes. And I've run into that a couple of times. So there's a risk to that strategy.
There is. I've always, we used to have arguments or debates, is mm-hmm. the right word, but between statisticians and people who have backgrounds in physics or engineering mm-hmm. On this topic, because statistically, it doesn't tell you how far beyond life you can go. But understanding physics and helps guide that discussion, particularly on failure mechanisms and how you model those. And so you really need input from people that understand statistics and people that understand physics and engineering to be able to answer questions like how far beyond the life can you go? What kind of assumptions are valid or not valid?
Yeah. Now, if your calculation shows that you need to go, you know, 300 lifetimes past it, I'm like, well, let's rethink this. This is probably not a good idea.
Probably not a good idea. Yeah. Or the other end of it is I'll only go, if the lifetime is 10 years, I'll go 1 year and assume exponential distribution or something like that. So you can make all kinds of errors.
Oh, yeah. 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 Yeah, and there's all kinds of challenges when you have limited samples. And, you know, the first thing you mentioned, which makes most sense, is, well, what are you trying to achieve? If I can use those 3 samples for a specific failure mechanism and run all 3 to failure, it's not great, right? But now I understand that failure mechanism way better, and I have at least a very crude, but at least some estimate. You know, you can do a Weibull with it, but it's sketchy. You know, don't expect great confidence bounds on it. But if you have prior knowledge or you understand the failure mechanism and you made some changes and you have a target Weibull that says if it's at least this good, then we're in good shape. And you run those 3 samples out to failure and hopefully they're on the good side of your target. Another idea is that, and that only works if you really only have 1 failure mechanism that you're most worried about. The bogey testing kind of works for when it's done well, when all the stresses are appropriate and so on, works well for multiple failure mechanisms, right? It's non-discriminatory, depending on how you set it up and run it. Another method is that you don't know what's going to fail, and that should ring bells of doing a halt test. You know, it's where are our margins? What kind of stresses cause it to fail? What kind of failures do we get? 3 samples is great for that, you know?
Yeah, and you're starting in the right place there because you're starting with objectives. And I like how you summarized it there. You sort of branch out as to whether you have a single failure mechanism or whether you have multiples that you anticipate or if you just don't know. It also, and I think it's important to understand where you are in the system hierarchy. Like, for instance, going back to my vehicle engineering experience, 3 vehicles is a lot different than 3 door handles.
Oh, yeah.
And because you have all the integration, like what can you learn from 3 vehicles? Well, you're going to learn some things. Depending on what stress profiles you introduce, but you're not going to find out what happens at a component level with any degree of accuracy or statistical inference. So it's that system hierarchy is a part of it as well.
It's true. And the other thing I think of when I get 3 samples is well, how many other prototypes are being made, right? Who's getting those?
Yeah. You know?
And not that I want to go steal them from them, but I want to put a bug in their ear, and no pun intended here, with the software guys to say, hey, if you see something wrong, tell us, you know, because they're running the system, they're running it. You know, I mean, I'm thinking of the, you know, like a computer system or any device that, hey, the software guys have to get stuff set up and they got to run products and make sure it works on their system. And they're trying this and that and the other thing. If it's clearly a software bug, which is what they're trying to find, well, they handle that, right? And we model that software out, hopefully, with their assistance. But it's, if they say, oh, the power supply failed, and I've run into so many of them that go, oh, it always happens on these prototypes. We keep a bunch of spares and we swap them in. And well, you got to write that down. You got to tell somebody.
Yeah.
You know, the electrical engineer doesn't know that that's failing because we just don't get the samples, right? And so they're doing the integration test, but it's, you can, if maybe they have three units and there's doubled your sample size, you know, it's not the most rigorous test as anything else, but you can still glean what's going wrong. And teams that understand that every failure on any prototype, any breadboard, anything is gold, you're way ahead of the game, even if you only get a couple samples for air quotes reliability work.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I was a reliability manager, you'd have a lot of different people working on stressing parts and systems. Mm-hmm. And some of them did it with design of experiments. Some of them did it with halt. Some of them did it with some type of reliability testing that is more statistical. And some of them, like you said, did it with prototyping, like they were doing some performance testing. Mm-hmm. Others were that we would have rides, you know, with different executives, and all that information would come back in different ways. Mm-hmm. And so as reliability manager, I remember creating these charts where I try to integrate. What can we learn from the prototype builds? What can we learn from the validation testing? What can we learn from accelerated testing of certain components? And all of them you can get individually in the silo. You can get some type of reliability inference or estimate, but aggregating it together to let the chief engineer, for example, know how are we doing overall on the project was not an easy task. No. Because some of the tests were highly accelerated, some of them were not. They were just performance. And it isn't just as simple as having a fracas where you're keeping track of failures and then trying to add them up and dividing by some number.
Right.
Because of the acceleration factors.
Well, it's also, you almost have to build a block diagram based on different use conditions, different failure mechanisms, and you can, it'd be one way to attack that. But it's kind of... If you can think that through before the rest of the teams get this stuff, then what I found is that I had the ability in some cases, not everyone, but in some cases to say, you know, what you're doing would be absolutely invaluable information. And I'm glad you're reporting the failures you're seeing, but I need to know the runtime. Right.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So just keep a log of your runtime, or set up a system that keeps track of how often this thing's powered up or operating or whatever, because just telling me I had a failure during the week and you only ran it for 2 hours is much different than if it ran for 160 hours.
And much different if you have other accelerated stresses.
That's right. And so by being aware of where the other units are, or where their components or subsystems are, and their conditions, allows you then to do that. Sometimes it's just gut feel. It's based on what kind of failure mechanisms you're seeing, and let's model that. Or if it's a known accelerant for a known failure mechanism, you can deal with it. And other times it's just, hey, we accumulated another 800 hours on this thing, and you know, we can't rule out that it's going to be great at 800 hours because we only had 18 samples total, but now it's a bogey test. We can interpret it that way, and we can chip away at aggregating these things.
Let's also look at this from a reliability management point of view. In other words, because this is the real world. So a reliability engineer is that their project team says you're going to get 3 samples. And if that's in the, and you may go lobby or try to get more or whatever, but let's say that's a given. So you're going to do your best with those 3 samples, and there's a lot that can be done, and we've talked about some of the things you can do. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, if you're not comfortable that that 3 samples is enough to tell you what you want to know, and that may be the case, there are other reliability tools that can supplement the testing. Mm-hmm. And so you may want to put more emphasis on FMEA. You may want to use a fault tree on certain events that you don't want to have happen. You may want to introduce more modeling into the reliability plan. If you know what the mechanisms of failure are. Mm-hmm. In other words, I often guide a reliability engineer to move towards the reliability plan. And 3 samples might be one portion of a reliability plan, but you can enhance other portions if you feel that's insufficient, mm-hmm. which it usually is. and so I think the getting going up to 30,000 feet, so to speak, and looking at it from a reliability management point of view is an opportunity for the engineer that's confronted with that type of problem.
Yeah. One other area that we haven't tapped yet is the suppliers and vendors. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it's a critical component and we've already done a bunch of research with them, or, it's a new novel materials or component or whatever. And there might be a lot of work done to understand its capabilities and performance and its reliability early on. Then you don't need 3 samples of that anymore. It might be just the integration piece that you need to be mm-hmm. aware of, right? And so it's use your prior knowledge of failure mechanisms, of your past field data, of your vendor's insights, but have a good, clean discussion with them saying, hey, we're going to put your power supply here with this kind of airflow and temperature and vibration and so on. What do we need to know about here? What do we need to be worried about? And if you're talking to the right person, not the sales guy, because he was, oh, that's perfect. It'll never fail. It'll be fine. Yeah. You got to talk to somebody that actually understands what you're asking and go, oh, yeah, this is what I'd look for. You're going to be in this issue, or you might want to dampen this vibration because of the tall electrolytic caps are going to fall off. Whatever. You can buy a clean, and it's more difficult than it sounds to sit down with a vendor and or a supplier, hopefully with one of their lead engineers that truly understands the ins and outs of their product and its reliability performance, and say, here's how we're using it. What risks are we facing here? And it's ideally it's done in a context of like an FMEA, but even just an hour phone call to get mm-hmm. a clean picture of where the risks are, then allows you to take whatever modeling or understanding or profiling you're doing to help you know whether you need to focus your 3 samples there or not.
Yeah, so I agree completely. And then the supplier base is a wealth of knowledge, and so are the internal experts that may not be on the project currently, might have mm-hmm. moved to different positions, but a reliability engineer can canvas out internally in the company as well, because there may be people that can bring that same type of knowledge in, even though they're not currently on that project. Right. And plus, we can look at field data and say, what can we learn from the field data for similar products that help guide us on the type of mechanisms to look for, mechanisms of failure. And also, if we can infer or gain knowledge about failure distributions from past information.
Oh man, I was working with these guys who were making a game controller, and they've been making them for years. And they, for whatever reason, they set up a end of line test that every month they basically replicated all of their quality control, and not quality control, all of their validation tests, including drop testing and cycling and temperature, humidity, and salt fog. And I mean, it was a couple of hundred samples every month and for years. And I probably have mentioned this group before where they didn't look at the data. And so I'm confronted with a new product on a tight timeline. And there was one new mechanism that they really was new. They're the only new thing on the device, essentially. But they wanted to run the full suite, and they wanted to run something like 600 samples through this thing. And it would have cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars just to set up, much less run and operate. And I'm like, what, you know, you guys have been making these other parts and pieces and molds and everything else for years. Why are we retesting these things? Oh, we always do that. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, that's the question. That is the question.
Yeah.
Why are we testing?
Yeah. So I, you know, got the old data and they understood CPK as a concept. So I said, you know, we got all of this test data on all these samples over years, and the CPK for the most risky thing you have is 18. And, you know, 2 is considered pretty good and 3 is wonderful, but you have such good process control and good vendors and good good design that you should never ever test this ever again.
This is a really important conversation because this comes back, and it's not trivial. Why are we testing? What are the objectives? I've told the story in some of our podcasts about back when we would test the door impact beams in the doors. Mm-hmm. Inside the sheet metal is this beam, and we would test it all the time. We'd get 3 samples in and test it, do a force deflection curve and maybe even more samples. And it was one of those DAW moments when we said, well, wait a minute. If we control the cross-sectional diameter of that door impact beam and the material composition, if we control it as special characteristics, both define what it needs to be and control it in the manufacturing process, maybe we can calculate the force deflection curves. We don't need to test those things to see if they meet the objectives.
Right.
And sure enough, that was the case. And so the question becomes, do you even need to test at all if you've done the right math and the right special characteristics, and we at least need to ask that question.
Yeah. So 3 samples may be, and I think we both agree, is usually not enough to address all of the risks and uncertainties and unknowns in a new product design. 3 samples might be more than you need, right? You might only need 1 or none. It really is situational of what you know and don't know and where the risks are. And so circling way back to what you started with, Garo, was, well, what's your objective? What are you trying to learn? What are you trying to achieve? If it's, you've got to check off a box that uses 12 samples and you got 3, well, now you got to do the hard discussion with the team going, well, which one of these 3 actually can teach us something? Which one can we learn what we need to know? And then we focus there. But yeah, we all face this. Sample size calculations is a great skill, and it's not just stats. It's what are you trying to do? It's what decision are you trying to influence?
Yeah, it really always comes back to that. That's a good summary, Fred. And one other comment is if you do test, try to test to failure, so you get the most out of those samples.
That's right.
But great conversation.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate the question. So if you're listening to this going, well, how do I get a question on the air with these guys? That's easy. We try to make it easy. Is head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. That's one way. There's a contact form there for you. You can find us on LinkedIn. You can find us on Ascendo on the About pages. And we're try to be visible and make it easy for you to get in touch with us. And we'll try to answer your question directly as soon as we get it, if we can, or help find somebody that knows how to answer the question. And on occasion, these questions are what just sparked the idea. This would make a good topic. And every now and then I get one that says, this would be a good topic for you. So I appreciate those and appreciate everybody listening. So we look forward to hearing from you, what your questions are. It helps us to, one, know that somebody's listening, but two, gives us interesting things to talk about that we suspect are of interest to you and to many other others in the listening pool. So with that, Carl, I think we'll wrap it up on for this one.
All right. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.